get started. Always good to have social hour, but sometimes it's better to have social hour after the meeting rather than before. Let's call this meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee to order. It is, looks like 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, July 13, 2022. Before we begin, I want to thank Sophia Tenney from Senate Records, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dania Burns and Dana Nicholas from the Juno and Anchorage LIOs, who make sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. The Joint Armed Services Committee is a joint committee made up of House, Senate, and public members. This year, the committee is being run by the Senate co-chair, Senator Schauer. I am chairing the committee today because Senator Schauer is only available remotely. I believe he is for the day in Indianapolis. And so present today from the Senate, we have my co-chair, Senator Schauer, on the telephone, Senator Rivak, Senator Holland, Senator Reinbold, and Senator Kawasaki online, I believe. Senator Kawasaki, you with us online? Doesn't sound like it. All right. And from the House,
Representative Tuck here.
He is here. Okay. From the House, we have Representative Sponholz. Representative Tuck, are you with us online?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Representative Tarr, Representative Nelson, myself, Representative Clayman. And I also want to recognize the public members we have present today. Colonel Jones, which is not here. Nelson Angapak, not so. Colonel Batalis, and Commodore Chase. No, and Brigadier General Julio Banez. No. Okay. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you all for attending. Our first and only order of business today is the Armed Service Briefing and Update. We will have an opportunity for questions at the end of each presentation. And the first presenter is Lieutenant General David Crum. Lieutenant General Crum, if you would please come forward, introduce yourself to the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Crum. To the members, is it okay if I sit?
Please.
You want me to operate the computer, so what could possibly go wrong?
You live in a world in which you're expected to stand for really long periods of time. We live in a world that we like to sit down.
Hey, first off, I want to thank the committee for having me today. You guys are special to our Alaska service members and their families. You're special because the care, the love, the concern that you show in not only in your individual, but in the state itself, it reflects back on our service members. They love the state and they love how you love them. So thank you very, very, very much for that. We have a number of different things and we can take this a couple of different ways. I'd ask your indulgence. And so many of you are very familiar with what we do up here in Alaska. And I've taken the liberty of doing something a little bit different this time. What I'd like to share with you is a portion of how I, over about the last 8 months, have been talking to the senior leaders, military, political, civilian, foreign, that come through Alaska, to talk to them about what's changing up here in Alaska and what are the things that we need to prepare ourselves for. Now, I won't cover all of it because we're in an unclassified setting, but I wanted to share this with you because as you guys look at your state and the things that you know that you need to do, you are incredibly focused at trying to make this work for what you guys need. What I'd like to give you is a little bit of a geopolitical of what we see is going to happen in this region based in no small part due to the environment. And so if we'll start with that, I'm glad to be here, me and my command chief, Command Chief Chris Berg, will open to your questions throughout this. And so what I'd like to do is walk through that at first, and at the end I'll hit specifically some things that I'd like to thank you for and offer as examples of maybe what we can use in the future. I don't know where all the slides will be. You know, we're military. We almost can't talk about a PowerPoint slide. So what I just want to talk to you a little bit about is what the Arctic opening and the implications for what we see going on up here. So one of the things I tell people is two to four times faster than the rest of the world.
It is correct.
And as we know, the difference between 31 and 32 degrees is a big difference when it comes to water. And so the warming trends that we are seeing are having, in my mind, three big impacts for us. And those impacts are some coastal erosion, permafrost, mostly all driven, though, by the retreating of sea ice. So if we look at those three impacts, what we tell people, hey, in the future here in Alaska, we're going to have to relook at some of the infrastructure that we built in the past because we did not anticipate the permafrost point. And an example is up at Eielson Air Force Base. We have a taxiway that every July, currently right now, through August, we have to severely restrict the weight limits of the aircraft that taxi. And that area has gotten bigger for the last 4 years. And so what we know is as the permafrost continues to melt, we're going to have to revitalize the infrastructure that we have up here to meet those changing environments. Because if we don't, we're going to have large swaths of areas that become unusable if we don't. So that's the impact for us on permafrost. And there's also been some swell with wildfires. Thankfully, we're getting rain today. That's hopefully just helping out with our fire situation. But this is a big issue for us, particularly when we talk about big pavement, right? And so large areas of pavement, and that's what runways are, at least for us, it's a big issue for us. If I ask you guys to look at, so this is just a picture. So like 1979 was the first time we got a picture from space of what the sea ice looked like. And as you guys know, September's when it gets to the minimum, it expands back out again. And you can see how much it's shrunk as far as the warming trends. And, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, too. Like, the sea ice is white. It's like sunlight. If the ice is there, the water absorbs more sunlight. But what we see is the sea ice is being fewer and fewer in the summer. What that means, and you all know this, especially for some of our Alaska native villages, about 30 villages right now are under threats from coastal erosion. When you have more periods of open water, and I'm fond of telling all the people that come visit us from Florida, you know, they get all worried about 80, 85 mile an hour winds, and they name it a hurricane, and we call that a Thursday up here in the Aleutians and along the coast, because we get some very intense storms. And so what the increased amount of water, open water, what we're seeing is erosion rates like we've never seen before. And it's affecting, and a lot of the long-range radar stations that we have are along the coast of Alaska. If I go to my next slide, this is the long-range radar station at Olympic. In 2012, we had the Corps of Engineers predict the rates of erosion that we would have. And so this is the lines they came up with. So that picture in the bottom left is that little shed on the overview with those line points. We are currently already at the erosion prediction for 2040 at that place. So we know we're going to have to spend a lot more on protecting our infrastructure in the areas that we have post erosion. So this is just an example. This is probably the worst example I have, but again, it's reflective of the fact that there's a lot more water, a lot more wind, and a lot more erosion going on. And we're having to come up with things like more seawalls, more rock, and whatnot. The other thing that the sea ice being at a more minimum level is it's providing access. It doesn't change the fact that it's hard to live up here. It's hard to survive and thrive up here. But I don't need to tell this committee the abundance of riches in Alaska and the Arctic. And that comes in the form of hydrocarbons, comes in the form of rare earth metals and other metals that we need. It comes in the order of fish, in the form of protein in the form of fish. And people and nation states are paying attention. And if you look at that picture, what I have there is, you know, you're looking down from the North Pole. And on the right side of that picture shows the northern sea route. That's the route that's already been utilized. I believe about 4 years ago, we had about 20 or 30 ships use it. In 2021, I think we had 390 ships use it. So if you're from East Asia and you take off a big container ship and you go to Europe, you can shave between 7 to 10 days of transit time by using the Northern Sea Route as opposed to going even through the Suez Canal. So it's a tremendous logistic change that particularly some of the manufacturing countries in East Asia are looking at as a possibility, particularly China, a possibility to really reduce transportation costs. The other thing is the open water is going to allow more, possibly more extraction of natural resources in the form of hydrocarbons and other things. And what we worry about is, you know, we as a nation will make the decisions that we want to make based upon our natural resources. But if other countries choose to make decisions, particularly Russia, the lack of environmental concerns that they have are reflected in some of the environmental damage we've seen in the Arctic. And so that's a concern for us. And then the other thing is protein. So this is a picture, and thanks to Admiral Moore and his folks for doing this. This is a picture of Chinese fishing vessel activity. And it's right off the Aleutian, so right outside our exclusive economic zone, our EEZ. And what you see is, you see a pattern of our, what we're seeing is the Chinese fishing fleets are coming closer and closer. They are not violating our EEZ, but they are getting closer and closer because, as this committee well knows, as the temperatures in the ocean rise, the fish are very sensitive, and they're moving further from. So, What we know is, hey, when you have an area that you can now access that has the riches of hydrocarbon, rare metals, fish, transportation corridors, you could save billions and billions of dollars, we know that that means that there is going to be increased activity up here. And what I emphasize to the people that I brief, that those nation states and human activity is going to increase, we need to prepare ourselves for that. We want the things that we do up here in the Arctic to be by choice, not by consequence. And so what I advocate for is the resourcing of the Arctic strategies that many of the services by DOD has provided as well. And I think that's a good first step. One of my bosses, General Van Erk, talks about the first thing we need to have is domain awareness. First, you need to understand what's going on before you decide what where you do in places. So that's the climate aspect that I will tell you that again, I've shortened it because I know we have a lot of people to talk about today. That, those slides and a couple others really ring true with some of the visitors that we get that start to understand they don't view the Arctic as a wasteland, but as a frozen patch of ice that no one can do anything with except submarines. But as a viable place for other nation states and us, and we need to be prepared for it. So that has resonated, like I said, with those visitors. The other thing that we understand is with the access in the Arctic, as well as evolving technology, particularly in the form of missiles, whether those be cruise missiles or hypersonic missiles, our homeland is no longer a sanctuary. So technology is enabling longer range weapons. And so what we know is we need to get better at being prepared for that. This past year, the first time ever, we bought a Patriot battery up to Isles City Air Force Base where we practiced the integration of a Patriot battery and Avengers into our cruise missile defense posture. And it was great. It wasn't cold enough. It only cut down like minus 19. I was really kind of mad. I wanted to really hit like a minus 50 day. But that still opened the eyes of some of our Army brothers and sisters about, hey, how do you sustain your people? But even more importantly, how do you sustain this equipment? This equipment had never seen that temperature before. And as you may well guess, if you bring up a Honda Accord from Florida, it might have a couple of different issues than some of the banks in the winter. The other thing that the threats that we're seeing are, you know, we talked about technology transfers and whatnot. Small UAS, so the little drone helicopters, and they range in size. Those are a serious problem to our bases. And I can't go into some specifics in the unclassified area, but I will tell you that we are concerned about the proliferation of those small unmanned aircraft systems. And we have very specific procedures in place that they should not be flying in and around on military bases. And it's not just what we call ISR intelligence, right? I don't want someone flying over and taking pictures in space. I certainly don't do that. But what we have seen in other parts of the world is even these very, very small things have been weaponized. You've seen that from the YouTube videos in Ukraine, where they can drop grenades or do other things. And so we are working very closely with the FAA, as well as DHS, on what is the right way to get after this. But it's a concern that I have going forward. And then cyber is always a concern. More and more we rely on cyber, the more and more vulnerable we become to cyber actors. So we've got to keep doing that. And it's not just infrastructure. We're looking at right now with the washout that occurred on the Michigan Highway that actually took one of our fiber optic cables. Now, we do have backups, but those are fragile in some ways. And so I've got fires on one side on the Parks Highway, and I've got a washout on the other side on the Richardson Highway. So we didn't really anticipate both of those things happening, but those are the things that we're working through on information. And the other thing is misinformation. We have an adversary that doesn't care about truth. We do. And so we're always combating this particular misinformation in the cyber realm. But that's what I'll offer to you for the rest of the Homeland Defense. Some things that I'd like your consideration, also to thank you in particular. I would like to thank the state, in particular the local area, that has worked very hard on working on the housing availability in and around Eielson Air Force Base. We have more work to do. As you well know, we'll finish up the additional F-35 personnel this fall in October. That will be when we reach our final numbers. At some point, we're going to be adding the personnel from the additional KC-135 Active Association that will augment our 168 wing guard unit up there. So that will be an additional up to somewhere between 225 to 250 more people. We have very much appreciate where the Bureau is, what the cities have done, and what the state has done. We ask that continue to build because we are not in a great position. I don't think there's any place in America that housing is in a great situation, but we are very, very pleased with some of the incentives that the state and the Bureau have offered. So thank you very, very much for that. I offered this to you as well, is we are actually seeing quite a big challenge with us in child care. As you know, about 50% of the people that we have do not live on the bases. They live out in the community. That is include our civilian employees, our contractors. Our members are finding it harder and harder to get child care for their children. And it's been a particular issue for us. One of the issues we have, again, not like anyone else is experiencing, or everyone else is experiencing, we are having difficulty hiring and retaining people to be child workers on the base. But we're also looking at, and I'm sure you and your constituents understand this, off-base child care, which our members use. They're also having difficulty keeping work and people on. So that's actually as more and more of our members. The family is a professional family. What I mean by that is the member and their spouse both work. And they don't just work in necessarily a minimum wage job. We have incredible professional spouses, which goes to the next point that you helped us out with. But child care has actually been quite a big issue. So anything that you can do to incentivize people in and around the state to be child care providers, we would welcome that, I would say. We're very grateful for the movement the state has made on military spouse license reciprocity. We would ask that work continue. I know there are a couple of actions that the legislature is in the middle of, but again, we have more and more of our service members with professional spouses and they are making decisions about whether or not to bring families to Alaska based upon the availability of work for their spouse. And having this has been helpful. The other thing that I'd ask the committee to take a look at is you've been very good to us, particularly on some of the medical providers that work on our federal installations. So our civilian and our military medical providers are able to work almost instantaneously in their own federal installation with their medical license. What may not be as well known is we actually don't fill all of our providers with just military or civilian employees. We also contract on to the federal installations. And what we're finding is some of them are facing a 90 to 100-day delay in getting their certification for the medical licenses approved by the state. So I'd love to look at, are there ways that we could do that better and work with you on making that a little bit faster? Because when we are able to hire and bring those, in particular behavioral health medical providers is where we're seeing this. Again, not big numbers, but they have really big impact to our families in particular. The other thing I'd like the committee to be aware of is we understand that the state is considering the public sales of some land. What we would ask is that as you look at approving that, we are particularly interested in any land that is sold underneath some military operating agreements. Because what we'd like to do is make sure that we still have the access to those areas to conduct the training that we do. The J Park in particular, near Fairbanks and Allison, is a gold mine. It is a treasure for our aviators to utilize. And what we would want to make sure of is that any sale of lands to private or corporations is done with that knowledge that training would continue. Also, we would like to make sure that if it is sold to individuals, we'd like to make sure that people that might be potential adversaries in the future would have access to those lands. We do some very sensitive training there. And what we would hate to do is have an adversary be able to buy land and then be able to park underneath and watch everything that we do. So as we go forward. The last thing that I just wanted to just share with you is environmental remediation. Many of you are probably aware that we recently got a new ruling on the levels of PFOA and PFAS that are acceptable, and the levels change dramatically. We don't know yet how that will affect, but we do know that wherever we're building, particularly on the air bases, we've had PFAS and PFOA, and we've had to store, and we're working on ways to get that contaminated material out. As an example, we paid almost $6 million to transport about 15,000 cubic yards of PFAS contaminated dirt miles in our space. I have an order of magnitude more contaminated soil. That is a very, very costly thing for your military to do. Because of the continued expansion of the building that we're doing, I would just like to offer to this committee that if you wanted to pursue things like, is there a way for us to be able to treat that soil up here? I think, unfortunately, we have a lot of soil that we need to work on. We want to do more building. There's more plans for the bases here in Alaska. I would just offer to you, the only place that we can use right now is a place of perhaps that there might be something that we could help with in identifying the amount of work that we would have to fix that soil. I know this is a long shot, but I don't like paying millions of dollars just to fix stuff. Maybe there's a better way to use those resources. And then the last thing, I'll obviously take your questions, and I look forward to your comments. Thank you for our commitment to our military members. Like I told you at the very start, they feel it. They feel the love the state has for them. And it gets them up for you, and I'll pay you back. So with that, question, sir, I'll appeal to U.S.
So I think what we'll do, because we've got two more presentations, and I'm somewhat cognizant of time. I know one of your colleagues is actually scheduled to has a little bit of a hard deadline for departure. What we'll do is we won't take questions now. We're going to get through both the other presentations, and then when we get the questions, they can ask who they want to ask questions to. But it's an excellent presentation. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Next up, their second presenter is Major General Brian Eifler. Major General Eifler, if you please come forward, be sure to introduce yourself and state your name for the record, and then you can proceed with your questions and with your presentation. As I noted, we're gonna hold questions until after all three presentations are done.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Major General Brian Eifler, Commander of the 11th Airborne Division and U.S. Army Alaska. And my trusty assistant here, Captain Aaron Swader here. If something happens to me during this brief, he's going to take over. If you've already read the news and you've been around for a little bit, you know that we had a huge transformation here on the 6th of June, something that I would consider as something that's long overdue. And so you are now the new proud members of the newest Army Division. It's a storied history that the 11th Airborne has, one of the five airborne divisions in World War II. It spent its time in the Pacific, which is the reason why, as you already know, we're assigned to Indo-PACOM. And so it makes sense to use the history from Indo-PACOM and the 11th Airborne Division. That's why we have the 11th Airborne Division, because we do a lot of our work across Indo-PACOM as well. As being the Arctic experts for the Army. We've never been told before in the past to do those things. And obviously, 2 years ago, both the Arctic and mountain experts, which makes us a very unique division. What I want to talk to you about today is what happened, why we did it, and just sort of play forward in case it's not clear. So I told you a little bit of why they made it the 11th Airborne. Really, we were improperly structured to do the mission that we did. Those of you that are familiar in the military, you know, if you went to North Carolina, you have the 82nd Airborne. If you took away their headquarters and basically said you're the United States Army North Carolina, put a couple of different patches on them, took away their mission, a little bit of their identity, you have a different unit. You'd have a unit with some problems. And so what we discovered is what we didn't have was mission, purpose, and identity. And so in one failed swoop, we basically fixed that. And so before, if you're familiar, we had all these different patches. We 4th Brigade of the 25th Infantry Division, which, oh, by the way, we're not into that at all. It's an I, or 1st Brigade of the 25th. Very confusing for people, let alone the soldiers that are serving in those units. So that in one fell swoop, we went to that one patch, the Arctic, as we called Binky, our polar bear, there, and now everybody's wearing the 11th Airborne patch. So, and then along with that identity came with the mission, which, hey, you're responsible not only for supporting Indo-PACOM, but also being the Arctic mountain experts for the United States Army. So that was, you know, that's our mission, purpose, and identity. So we are a very unique division. We're not completely airborne. Okay, so the brigade up north is a striker brigade. It's in the midst of transforming into a light brigade. In other words, the strikers are being turned in, and they'll become a light fighting force, much like the 6th Infantry Division was back before it was deactivated. So it's going to be a light force and more focused on air assault. So you're going to have this division that's very unique, that's partly airborne, partly air assault, have the mission in the Indo-PACOM AOR, also responsible for being Arctic experts, which brings us over to the over the top of the pole to support Norway, Sweden, Finland. As you know, they want to work with units that are experts in the Arctic. So they want to work. So we have that sort of confluence of combat commands with the European Command, the Indo-PACOM Command, and NORTHCOM is where we sit. So very strategic. It's been strategic ever since we've been here with a unique mission and a unique division makeup. So that's that's sort of what's happening. So the Army is basically fixing and putting into place, which is long overdue, which will give us better abilities, capabilities to do what we need to do in the Pacific as well as in the Arctic. So what will that look like? Well, will we reduce forces? No. Still have about 12,000 soldiers in Alaska, but we're going to change the structure and organize it properly so we can do better training, better supervision and oversight, and have better capabilities to do things that we've been being asked to do, or maybe we've been asked to do and not really capable. So not getting into the details, but our division headquarters expands a bit. Right now it's largely manned by great civilians. We don't have a full, for example, intelligence shop. We just have a few for logistics. So that will expand. Have a division artillery unit that will come in. And so some changes will happen, but there'll be really a lot of rearranging to maximize the effectiveness and efficiency for what those missions are. You see on there with the Army, Chief of Staff, when he came in on the 6th of June, he gave us those direct guidance, which I framed and entombed in bronze in our headquarters. That's what our mandate is to do, is to remember that we have a legacy from World War II to live up to, as well as being the Arctic experts and getting back to that Arctic ethos that we used to have here. So the combination of our history and our future makes this division pretty unique. So if we go to the next slide. So last year, and I kind of talked to you last year about JTMRC, the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center, which basically, if you're familiar with Army parlance, we used to go to JRTC and NTC, Joint Readiness Training Center in Fort Hope, Louisiana, and then also in the National Training Center in Fort Irwin, California. A lot of money spent transporting troops and equipment to those locations. A lot of time spent getting it there, leaving it there, and getting it back, which eliminates the ability to be ready now. So what we're able to do and what we did last year was create this Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center. We like acronyms, so come up for JMPRC. And so we can stay in the region where we need to be able to train and fight. So Fort Hope, great place to train. Fort Irwin, great place to train. But nothing replicates what we have here if we want to be a part of the force. And so we did that last year. We put about almost 10,000 soldiers in the field, probably the largest we had in two decades. We'll do the same thing again this year. It's joint for us. That in the military parlance, it means the Air Force, the Marines. We also have a multi-compo. Coast Guards are welcome to join us, but they're a little bit farther out from the inland than they have responsibility for. But it is a multinational as well. So we had Canadians, Indians, Japanese. We have a lot of nations that have Arctic forces that want to work with this. So we'll continue to do that. And we'll put large forces in the field in the winter. It's got a little late this year. It's going to be in towards March. But if you know anything about this, shoulder months in Alaska are probably more difficult than the extreme cold. We can handle the extreme cold. It's just how we test and improvise and adapt to the Arctic, as one of the mandates from the Chief Staff said, is like, hey, you figure this stuff out. The Army likes to say, hey, here's your new boot. That should be good, right? One boot. Well, as you know, we'll boot for what? You need one for climbing? You need one for skiing? You need one for hiking? You need one for ice? That's what we're trying to help inform the Army what it takes to not just operate, but also fight and win in these extreme conditions. And they're realizing, and they're listening, that, hey, you can't just do a salami slice. Hey, here's your boot for the Arctic. Now, we need a couple of different options. So we're doing that through things like JPMRC training and doing sustained operations in the extreme cold. But as you see on the other part of that slide, is we're doing it with a lot of different nations, across not just Indo-Pacific, but also in other Arctic nations on the other side of the world. And so a lot of the nations that we like to focus on, say Indo-PACOM, very hot, very hot, warm climate. But we're working with India and the Himalayas. We'll be there this fall on the border with China. We got, obviously, Nepal, Mongolia mentioned, during operations with them, began with their Northern Army and their extreme cold in mountains in Korea. So we've got about five countries that we're working with in across Indo-Pacom that do have that extreme cold weather mountains terrain so that we can continue to develop those allies and partnerships. So that's really all I wanted to talk to you guys about today, and I wanted to leave time for questions. So I know we're going to do that at the end, but it's about transformation. We've been repackaged, had a mission, purpose, and identity now, and we're moving out smart. So really appreciate the support that you provide to the military general conference. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Major General Eifer. And next in the next up, we have Rear Admiral Nathan Moore. Admiral Moore, if you want to come forward, introduce yourself and state your name for the record, and you can present. Move forward to your presentation.
Okay, thank you, sir. So, yeah, my name is Admiral Nathan Moore. I'm the Coast Guard District 17 Commander, which is the coast of Alaska, coast of Alaska and the Arctic. And Lieutenant Schmidt is here to help drive the presentation. So, I thought I would just, from the maritime perspective, you know, give you an overview of what your Coast Guard's doing here in Alaska. And I think it will be a really good complement to what you just heard from Bill Eifer as well. So if you go to the next slide, right? This is one that I show a lot, sort of gives you what we encountered just last summer, really September, October timeframe, out in the Bering Oceans and in the maritime space. Probably not telling you anything you don't already know, but a great power competition is back. I'm not sure that was left, but it's definitely back today. So if you kind of work your way around this slide over there on the left-hand slide, number one, and starting over there, you'll see what we normally do, and we've been doing this for decades along the maritime boundary line, which is the maritime boundary between the shared EEZs of West and Russia. National security cutters, those are new frigate-sized ships that are out in the Bering at all times these days, working with the Russians and simultaneously actually ensuring rules-based order with them. We continue to do that today. You see both pictures number one and two. One shows us patrolling. Ourselves, number two there, is the Russian Border Guard ship that we interacted with last year. Even post-Ukraine invasion, the Coast Guard is one of the few agencies specifically called out by the Department of State as having authority to work with the Russians today. We do not, we are not working with them in the sense that we are, that I'm hosting them for cocktail parties and taking pictures with them. But if there's a mass rescue, an oil spill, any kind of maritime emergency along the U.S.-Russian maritime boundary line, I am authorized to speak with them. We do communicate with them, when necessary, for deconfliction purposes, because they are our neighbors. And with any neighbors, if you're not talking to them, that becomes very dangerous. So the longstanding relationship with Russia that the U.S. Coast Guard has, and that continues today for emergency situations. If you work your way up to number three there, that's an example of us working with the Canadians. Number three is not the Canadians. Number three is the PRC, right? So you see the People's Republic of China, those old red ships, that's not the Canadians. Those are their intel collection ships that they bring up through the Bering Strait and international waters. They bring up into the Chukchi and the Arctic Ocean. They've been doing that for years. We monitor them closely, and as General Crump said, domain awareness is essential in this region. It continues to be today. Then as you work your way across to four, that's our icebreaker. Five, there's the Canadians, right? The U.S. Coast Guard as well. That is obviously a long-standing relationship as we work off the coast of the U.S. and, of course, along the maritime boundary that we share with Canada, which is the Northwest Passage Route, as you all know. That is something that we continue to coordinate with both transits through Northwest Passage and security, search and rescue capability, and oil pollution response care for oil. And then the partnerships go down to six and seven. That is a South Korean naval vessel that came through last summer. And that met with them, and then you also see seven there, and Japanese JMSDF, and then you also see Royal Canadian Navy ship that came up, one of their new ships, the Harry DeWolf, And then last, and throwing out page number 8 there at the very bottom, you see where the red stars are. That's correlates with the pictures. That red star there inside the Aleutian chain, that is a Chinese PRC, PLAN, Chinese Navy strategic action group that came up inside the Bering last year. And we went out to meet them. We had a national security cutter that was on scene with them. It's international waters. They are perfectly legal for them to be there. But from a domain awareness standpoint, from a national security standpoint, your Coast Guard is your naval component up here that can get out on scene with them and make sure they know that you know they're there. So this was last year. This same activity continues this summer. And as we get into the fall, I would expect almost all of these situations to repeat as they typically do. Okay, next slide, please. So shifting gears here quite a bit, Anya, I wanted to just mention quickly for your awareness at the state level here, we have been troubled here in Alaska on the Coast Guard by a string of suicides. We had 3 suicides in 3 months starting earlier, just after Christmas of this past year. And actually, General Eifler has been a very good friend to me and helped me kind of get my arms around how to tackle this and move forward. But we have worked very, very hard to get our folks reconnected with each other and actually form bonds in person. And I think after 2 years of COVID, 2 years of doing a lot of Zooms and remote meetings and coming out of normal, seasonal depressive issues that some people have here in Alaska, and we had just lost focus on that. If people were struggling, our young people today struggle with human connection and staying connected with the Coast Guard. I think even different than the Army and the Air Force here in Alaska, we are very dispersed. And if we have places, as many of you know, you look at Dutch Harbor or Homer or Seward or places out like Cordova, we have pockets where you may only have 15, 20, or 25 Coast Guard billets in one place. And that, so if you are a young person who's on a crew of only 15 people in Homer, and you don't get along with one of those 15 people on the crew very well, you're pretty low. That is a rough place to be. And so we have, launched out a lot of help from our partners in the local communities and others to get our folks kind of reconnected and improve our mental health and suicide prevention efforts for our folks. Okay, next slide. So in the meantime, we're certainly continuing our domestic operations here. I touched quite a bit on sort of the international sovereignty and great power competition piece. This is just good old bread and butter Coast Guard, right? We're still doing things like vessel facility examinations. We're doing safety examinations. We are continuing to do aids to navigation, as you see there in the center picture. We're continuing to do things like coastal fishing, vessel boardings. We continue to do medevacs off of cruise ships, medevacs off of commercial ships, and certain fishing vessels. We still have a pretty solid link with the Discovery Channel for Deadliest Catch, and we're still on that every once in a while if you pay attention to that show. So all of your traditional Coast Guard missions continue here in Alaska, and we're happy to see that move forward. We have new assets coming in the Coast Guard, both from a aviation and a surface standpoint. We have the first 5 C-130Js at the Coast Guard fielded anywhere in the country in Kodiak. Last one arrived last year, so we got the first 5 there. We've got UH-60Js, our version of the version that we use of the Black Hawk helicopter, that continue to be to roll out. We're going to see more of those come to Kodiak in the future. And then from a shipboard standpoint, we have new cutters commissioned in Ketchikan. We have a new fast response cutter that's commissioned in Ketchikan in September, and then we are going to follow up in the next 2 years with 3 more of those cutters being stationed out in Kodiak as well. So new assets coming. I made it this far without talking about Coast Guard icebreakers, which is pretty good for a Coast Guard presentation. But we do, the Polar Security Cutter is coming, and we'll operate here in the Arctic, obviously, as it's intended. Infrastructure-wise, I think General Crum did a nice job of explaining climate change. One area that we struggle with considerably is communications infrastructure, and what you're seeing here, as you see in the slide here, Southeast Alaska and then the coast of Central Alaska, these high sites are primarily our VHF repeater high sites. They are microwave link and generator powered by diesel generators. And as you can imagine, if you put a diesel generator on a mountaintop unattended in Alaska, it doesn't run forever. And they are in bad need of repair or replacement. Most of these systems have been replaced. In the future, it's very clear that the future of this comms network for us, it's got to be something different than diesel power generators on mountaintops. And the technology is going to get the Ghost Cart there. If you think about satellite capabilities and that sort of thing, this system is specifically designed for repeating of VHF Channel 16, if you think about it, out on the water for search and rescue. So most places where you go in these regions of coastal Alaska, the mountains block VHF signals, and for our purposes, that's incredibly dangerous. Now we've got to have a way to be able to talk to Americans in distress through VHF. So that's something we're working on right now. Okay, next slide. Then on the shore infrastructure, and from a larger standpoint, maybe just to end on this point, Coast Guard has incredible amounts of funding that we've got over the last couple of years, both from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act that was passed last year, but also just from the Coast Guard budget ourselves, our own acquisition. Infrastructure funding, a real signal to us of the importance of Alaska, has been the support that we are getting to do things like build new housing in Kodiak. We've got another string of almost 100, I think the number's around 80, new homes in Kodiak. And so if you've been to Kodiak, that is the largest Coast Guard base in the Coast Guard in the country. And we continue to make it larger. I just mentioned we're going to put the ships there. That comes with new housing because there are no other places for our Coast Guard families to live. We've got covered moorings that we're looking at. That's a picture of Valdez that you see there in the lower right. It makes it difficult for us to keep our small boats in a ready status when they're constantly shoveling out of snow there in Valdez. Covered moorings there. And then the upper right is Sitka. And that old wooden pier is partially condemned, but we've got a new cutter that we'd like to move in and bring there. We are unable at this point to do that because we're working with the state to try to get some land right along the coastline there, as you see in the picture. But it's been a challenge for us to actually execute that project and then get the land to expand as we'd like and sit and build out for that new cutter that's coming. So lots of funding available in for shore infrastructure for us, but a challenge, of course, to continue to actually execute those projects and get them out. And I thought with that, maybe I'll stop. Hopefully that's spurred some thoughts and maybe some questions for you. I'm really happy to take them. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. And we'll get to the last presenter. Thank you for adding one more. We'll get to the last presenter, and then we'll get to questions. The last and final presenter is Major General Torrance Sachs. Major General Sachs, if you want to come forward, introduce yourself, state your name for the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Major General Tori Sachs, Alaska TAG. I've got Robin Gable here with me. I think most of you know her. And I also want to thank the vets on the board. I see a couple guardsmen as well, so even one retired one. So, yeah, it's good to be back. It's good to be back in person. Just a few things. I had a commander's call about a week ago, and to my knowledge, it was the first one, at least in the last 20 years, where we had all the commanders from the entire state show up in person so I could talk to all of them in the same room. And this is one of the slides I showed, and I want to give you the perspective I have, but also to thank the three gentlemen that came before me. Because I've been here for a while, and it really is a pleasure when you know the people you work with on active duty, you get along with the people you work with on active duty, and we've been a good team. So thanks, James. But a few things. If you look at the picture, should you join the military? I think everybody here knows this, but I heard the stat a couple days ago. It's not 10%. Veterans within Alaska, it's actually 13%. And that's over 10 times the national average. And if you take it out to 1 degree of separation, talking about husbands, wives, et cetera, you're talking about roughly 40% of the state that has a direct connection to the military. This fundamentally is a different state with a different type of culture. It's very military-centric. So I want to give an example. And the reason I have a car accident, this is something that happened to me about 20 years ago, but it really showed me in person how much people, especially in rural Alaska, think about the military and what they expect. So again, it was a sad story, but there's a couple kids, I won't say the town, but they skipped school, they took a car, and they were driving it too fast, going around a corner, and they rolled it, no seatbelts, and one of the kids flew out of the car, and unfortunately the car rolled on top of the child, and he was killed. So, again, not a whole lot of details, but there were many people in my unit that were either directly associated with the kids or indirectly. So I was the acting commander that day, not even the commander, but I got a call to go down to this community, and, of course, very emotional, lots of stress, lots of crying. And I'll never forget, the mayor of this town came up to me and said, as I was walking towards it, it's going to be okay because the commander is here. Okay, so that has always stuck with me, that there is an expectation. That's the word I use, an expectation that the military delivers within Alaska, both on the state side, both on the federal side, and anything that we can do, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I have the picture of the stop sexual assault. We had an inspection about a month ago, and I'm very happy to report, I'm going to paraphrase the report, that we are now a model, if not the model, for the entire National Guard on how to do things right. And so that's something I've passed to my boss, the governor, and certainly to people within the organization. But the Air Force has a saying for safety, it's not a program, it's a culture. So that's what we're doing within the National Guard. It's not a program, it's a culture, to respect people and that respect and dignity. Next slide. All right, just a few things as far as the global scene. And this is something, of course, the military is talking about. Most of the conferences I go to, INDOPACOM, USERPAC, lots of acronyms, the leaders within the Air Force and the Army. I wanted to point out Ukraine in particular, because you may have heard on the news, the California National Guard has a special relationship with Ukraine. And to give you an example, they had a tactical issue, I believe, with one of their tanks, and they couldn't figure out what to do. And so they texted somebody from the California National Guard to ask this very tactical question in the midst of the battle, and they got it figured out to move forward and be successful in their mission. That's the type of relationship I want to establish with Mongolia. That's our country for the Alaska National Guard. And if you look on the map, just a very strategic location between Russia and China. So next slide, please. It's been talked about a little bit, so I'll just hit this very briefly. But yes, at a very unclassified level, North Korea has range, and this is something that we're concerned about, but we have many forces within the state that are actively looking at this every single day. Next slide. So missile warning. Again, at an unclassified level, this is what would happen with a missile launch. So assuming it came from potential adversaries, Russia, China, North Korea, it would be seen by Shimia, which is on the Aleutians. At the same time, it would be seen by our satellites. We call that dual phenomenology. That just means you're looking at the space base and the ground base at the same time. Clear would pick it up. They would have 1 minute to make a human determination system. It would go down to the Missile Warning Center, NORAD, and there would be a determination and a recommendation made to the president. At the same time, Fort Greely would be taking their actions as well. Lots of infrastructure to get this right. But what I wanted to point out is almost every entity I mentioned is operated by National Guardsmen. Fort Greely, Clear, for example, and certainly many in Colorado. Next slide. A lot of times within the Guard, we do a state focus. This is just a typical day. I took off the names of the units, but these are places on one given day that we're deployed to in the not too recent past. So if you look at the past 2 years in particular, this has been among the busiest times federally for our deployments with everything that's been going on the state side of the world. Next slide. This is what we call rural operations, and we are focusing on the hub armories. So we're going down from 83 to 19. So bigger places such as Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, for example, these are places that we want to recruit to. This is something I can most definitely use your help on. And these are also places that we train. So a very bright spot, just one of the photos that you see on the right-hand side, that is Chivik. And of all the places in Western Alaska, all the places within Alaska in a rural area, that is by far the brightest spot. We're getting quite a few people from a relatively small place. The picture in the very bottom right, that is a commissary run we did last year to Bethel, and we had about 200 people and $10,000. So we're trying to get those entitlements, those benefits, the places off the road system, and we fully intend to do that again. On the bottom left, that is the Kodiak Armory. We're in the process of naming that for Private Daniel Harmon. He was a Vietnam vet, fortunately, that was killed in action. So that is another request I have. If you have veterans, they're from a given locale, we want to get that community buy-in to our armories like we did in the past. Next slide. This is what we have done with your guard. Three phases. I've had some version of this every command I've had. Phase one is you have to have something, meaning a unit on a solid foundation. Two, we are Alaskan, that's the focus on the state, and you're always going to be in some version of this two phases. And number three, if you got those right, make sure you're doing it right at the national level as well. The next slide. We have focused very strongly on building leaders. Lots of things we've done as far as mentoring, grooming our replacement. On the bottom right, that is Colonel Ellis. He was a recent speaker we had. He was in the Hanoi Hilton for 5 years, a prisoner of war for 5 years. And there's just a lot of discussion about suicide. And to hear his perspective on how he survived, how his fellow comrades survived in the midst of just absolute torture, really good life lessons, not just for the military, but the things we can take back, makes us better leaders, makes our troops better leaders as well. So bottom line is, you see in the upper left, I need to own it, and everybody within my organization, especially in leadership, needs to own it. It's your responsibility. Next. Okay, one more. This is the state focus, and we want to build those relationships, yes, with the people here in the room on the JAS, but certainly the Coast Guard, Alaska Command, 11th Division, congrats again on that. But we build our strength because we are permanent party by establishing those relationships and being the continuity. And I'm very aware of that. So as we all move on, whoever follows all four of us, want to make sure this relationship remains strong because there's strength and unity, and especially with what could be on the horizon. Who knows what's on the horizon, but we want to make sure that we're going forward as a team. Next slide. These are the things that we're doing as far as rural outreach, just a few photos, but I understand when you get invited to a fish camp, that is one of the best things that could ever happen. That certainly was for me. So that's down by the Bethel area. But what I have found is we just had a fire not too long ago in St. Mary's, and the relationships that we had established ahead of time, we evacuated roughly 100 people. There was a potential we were going to evacuate the entire village of about 700 people. And to know the people by name, that we had the relationships established ahead of time, it was about as smooth as you could have made it under those circumstances. So it is paying dividends to get out there and to make sure that you know people ahead of time. As I always say, I don't want to introduce myself in a crisis. So just other things there, going to some local high schools and know Operation Santa Claus. That's me in the middle of there. Yeah, in the hat. Next slide, please. I mentioned the federal side and just a few things on the state side that we've done over the past 2 years. In the midst of COVID, this is something perhaps not everybody here in the room knows we did. Election support in civilian clothes. We sent out able militia, state defense force, National Guard, and we went to many of the polling places around the state just to make sure that people have the opportunity to vote. So this is just a slide we took from one of the days to show some of the places that we went. Next slide. And I mentioned the federal side, how busy it's been. There is no question in-state usage of the National Guard has been busier past 2 years than at any time over the past 25 years combined. We've had more hotel state deployments. So to Low Point, giving out food during COVID, and for some of the things we've done at Mammoth Hospital. Next slide. Again, building those relationships, this is something that just happened, not the event, but the attempt to honor. So honoring our heroes. Going to go through this quickly, but to show 1955, there was a U.S. Navy patrol plane that shot down by the Russians. So next slide. A little bit more here, too. MiGs shot it down. The closest place was Gamble, and the Russians were circling, and they were trying to find a crew to take them, presumably, for prisoners. Again, this happened on our turf in 1955. Not a whole lot of folks know of the history of this. Next slide. So very bad damage. The crew was in dire straits. So what happened, next slide, is our Alaska Scouts, Alaska National Guard, they got to the injured crew before the Russians brought them to safety in Gamble, and they have never been properly honored. So that is exactly what we're doing now to make it right. More slide. This is a picture of the crew when they were finally brought back to get some medical help. but some of the people from the Alaska Scouts are still alive. They're still in Gamble, and we tried last week to get there, but the weather just didn't cooperate. So one more slide. That's why you see the date of 9 July. But we are going to go back soon, if weather allows. I'm going to go back in person. That's the plan. But this is a list of the people that we're going to honor. And you can see in the text above, I did authorize the highest honor they could possibly get for their efforts, and they're going to get that medal you see there. So for heroism. And you see, we all age over time, but the before and after photos of some of the great warriors who performed that act, we are going around the state. And again, this is something that can come, but if there's any story out there you think needs to be made right, we'd like to make it right. And this is how you build those relationships. You see the smiles and the actual people who did these things, they're still alive. We'd like to get to them why they are still alive, and we can say thank you. Next slide. Phase three, going at the national level. A lot of this you can get by the three previous briefs, but a few things, next slide, that you can help on. There's a bit of overlap here between what General Crum asked and what I'm going to ask. Quality of life, I have at least one person perhaps on the board, so to speak, that knows this. I did a tour of our barracks a couple years ago, and there were roughly 40 soldiers to one bathroom. So we are making that right, and it's not going to happen anymore. So I have a tour coming up that looking for funding. That's important. I don't want anyone to have to go through that unless they have to go through that. We're talking on a major installation. That's not something that they should have to do. Also, at Fort Greely, the Tanker KC-135 Association, just more of your situational awareness, since that's already been brought up with Joan Crum, the housing situation. Thank you for your support on that. And for all the folks that may be hearing me, I'm sure, thanks. Thank you so much for all your help. We are looking for the next generation rescue helicopter for search and rescue. Our PJs, our combat rescue officers, they do roughly one save a week all year long. Yeah, it's just an amazing thing that they do. Day in and day out, all times the weather. And lastly, for the Space National Guard, we have a small unit cleared, and we're looking to transition them out of the Air Force, Air National Guard, into the Space Force, Space Station. Next slide. Questions?
All right. Well, thank you very much, General Sachs. And so this opens up for committee questions, and since we've had full presentation, I ask you to let us know who you'd like to come forward and answer your question. Got a cue going, if any, Representative or Senator Reinbold.
My recommendation, Chair Klayman, would be that possibly all four gentlemen, our brass, our wonderful brass, could possibly all come up to the.
This
will be a lot quicker.
Why don't you start with a question that you have, and we'll get somebody up. We end up there. But go ahead and move your first.
Okay, the first one I'm going to put to the very first presentation. So, first of all, General Crum, you said that our ice was getting smaller during the summer. You did not mention what was happening in the winter. Do you mind expanding on that?
Well, Senator, what we've seen for the most part is the ice comes back to about the same place in the winter. A lot of it then becomes new ice, which is, I know the community is familiar with this just a little bit. But so the ice is able to be broken through a little bit easier. We saw that occur in last year when we had two natural gas tankers come out of Russia in February and able to break through ice fairly easily as they made their way down East Asia. So I don't have the exact details, but I don't see the retreat in the wintertime as much as we had in the summertime.
Good, Chair.
Follow up?
So, yes, follow up. Climate has always changed. It will always change. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's the way, you know, we were taught there was an ice, you know, freezing coming, you know, in my early days, and now it's a global warming. So it's global warming. So bottom line, it's always going to change. It always will change. So do you have any information? What do you think is contributing to climate change?
Senator, I don't know why it's happening, and that's not my role. My role is to posture ourselves so that we can prepare for what's happening. And what we see is that because the ice is being a lot more minimal in the summertime, there's a lot more access. So I don't have a speculation or a reason as to why it's happening. I just want to prepare ourselves for what is happening.
Couple more, just okay. So basically, there's
Representative Reinbold. Go ahead,
Senator Reinbold. Yes,
I apologize, Senator Reinbold. My apologies.
So bottom line is, I would just like to know so we can help mitigate. You know, mitigate. There's no help that there's erosion going on, and there is consequences to the warming or the potential freezing in the future. But I really think that's important. You said misinformation was one of your top things. Can you expound in regards to that, please?
Senator, we're always concerned about misinformation in space. You know, we've seen things like that come out of Russia and Ukraine. We've seen it come out of China. It's just one of the things that I'm concerned with in the cyber arena. If we get to a crisis situation, we have to make sure that we include our truth in those operations. So the fact that an adversary might put out falsehoods about the situation or what's happening could impact that situation itself. So for me, it's just one of those things I have to understand as a commander, that my service members have to be prepared for that, to not be affected by the misinformation, but also make sure that we're putting out the correct information.
Last follow.
And so what I would like with, in the broad, hopefully all our brass, our honorable brass, would be able to answer this. We don't get, as even JAS, Joint Armed Services, we don't even get any type of security briefings or anything, so we're kind of find out what we know in the press. But I think it's very, very important to know what is the biggest threat to Alaskans, because we are elected officials and people look to us. They think we know more, you know, than we do about potential threats or what's facing either domestic enemies or abroad. And I've been working on disaster plans on and off for 5 years. It's something that's really important to the constituents, whether it's wildfire, earthquake, or whatever. You guys get a lot of security clearance and a lot of information, and we're wondering, is there anything we can do? It's a different situation the last couple of years, and we feel differently than what we felt before. If there's anything you can do to tell us as elected officials what we can prepare for, or do we prepare just in general?
Well, Senator, what I would say is your continued support of the things that we ask for enable us to do, particularly for Homeland Defense. So when we start talking about different things that we are going to do, some more exercises, like I mentioned before, the inclusion of the Patriot Battery was a first for us. So the way that, as we look at how we're going to do Homeland Defense, how we're going to defend our homeland in the future, I think it's actually going to change quite a bit, because the threat is going to change as well. And your support in just making sure that the things that we identify, go, hey, these are some of the structures that we need to build, there's an access we need to build. General Van Erk has talked very specifically about domain awareness, so you're helping us realize that we need to understand what's going on up here first. I think that those are the things that I'd ask your help with. The threat is morphing, the threat is changing. We think that we protect the homeland very well, and we're very, very proud of that. I don't see an immediate threat right now. But again, I always want to look forward to that anything that we're doing is not by consequence. So that's what I would say, Senator, to that.
So we've got a growing queue, Senator Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, General Crum, but thanks to all of you.
If you want to call anybody else up.
I was going to suggest we maybe prioritize questions by the presenter who's at the table right now. My question was for General.
We've got a long queue, so just go.
So you mentioned the northern routes opening up. I just had a question, if you're aware. So the fleet's interchangeable. When these northern ships start moving towards northern route, do they have to be escorted by icebreakers, or do they have to rely on hulls that are able to handle icy routes? Or
the answer is yes, Senator. What I mean by that is, and one of the things that we disagree with the Russians on is the Russians declared that the Northern Sea Route is in territorial waters. It is not. It is in international waters. It is inside their EEZ at places. But the Russians have said, if you are going to come to the Northern Sea Route, you will do these things because it's our territorial waters. And they've, I don't know the exacts, but they do request a payment. They request a Russian pilot be put on board. we understand why some of the reasons why they want to control that, but also, as you well know, the amount of resources in the Arctic to do search and rescue, to do recovery of transportation vessels, are very, very limited. So I think that they've been looking at that. We foresee that as the ice continues to shrink, there will probably be times we don't want the Titanic being repeated, obviously, with someone hitting an iceberg. I think what we've seen so far is most of the time, either they are being escorted or they are ice-hardened holds. But I think what we've seen, and particularly from the Chinese and their interest in the transportation corridors, is the hope is that they will not have to do that. The hope is that they will be able to use normal shipping vessels during the ice-free times in the Arctic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, General Crum.
Senator Reback.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, General Crum, and everybody that's here. I think my question is maybe for General Crum, more for General Eifler. Two parts. First, I guess, just a comment. Military spousal licensure, we took a big step. It's something that the legislature has been focused on for some time. I just would like to point out that we passed SB 21, which requires licensure, temporary licensure within 30 days. And so what I guess my ask there is that if that isn't happening, first I want to make sure that you're all aware of that. If that's not happening, please let us know so that we can, or have those folks in those situations come to us. I certainly would appreciate that, because we want to make sure that that's being implemented correctly. And I know we have some work to do, so thanks for bringing that to our attention. Secondly, General Eifler, suicide has been a big issue in Alaska. We've dealt with it for a long, long time. Everyone knows we have the worst statistics in the nation related to death by suicide per capita and some other maybe root causes and effects. But I've noticed recently, I actually served with the division chaplain in Iraq together, and so just a kind of a brief conversation with him, not as recently as I'd like, I heard that there's great progress. You mentioned identity, and you mentioned purpose and motivation and some of the characteristics that you're trying to instill and sort of the division stand up. But I'm curious, I heard something about a Mission 100 or some other, I don't think you've had a suicide in quite some time in comparison, and I think that's something to be really proud of. My question is what are you doing that's working, and thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. So you should just identify yourself for the record. General Brian Eifler, everyone to visit. So we have started about almost 7 months ago, Mission 100, which is about the operationalizing, so soldiers understand mission. So we gave them a mission, Mission 100, 100% connection. Right. Connection, as Admiral Moore showed up there, a connection brings hope. Hope is, as we say, hope is our weapon against us. So people that fall prey to suicide are absent of hope. Hope being a weapon, that's what we're trying to get. So Mission 100 was put in place to get after that connection. If you're really connected, not contact, over email, any type of form of social media, but a real connection that him and I share, talk, discuss on difficult subjects, that exposes that connection so that I know I have a problem. I've talked to him about things like this before. I know I can go to him. I can trust him. Vice me just connecting isn't a connection. So we wanted 100% of our formation connected, soldier to soldier, leader to soldier, and then also leader to the soldier's next of kin, or maybe it's a parent, maybe it's an aunt, a grandmother, it could be a spouse, but so that they know that there's a person in the Army, persons in the military, not this big institution. They can call on, squad leader Crum here and ask about Brian, or say, hey, I haven't seen Brian in a while, or I think something's wrong. Instead of trying to call the Army, I can call this guy because he reached out to me. And he also said, nothing's going to happen to your son on my watch.
and I'm going to make sure he achieves his goals and dreams. And I'm not going to do anything stupid on my watch either. It's that ownership. But that's to take the connection. That's not, you know, nothing against some of our commercial businesses, but this is why we're all in this profession. That's a 24/7. That's not a 9-to-5. They don't bother me. It's after 5. So this is 24/7. That's what we're trying to get to, that connection. So we do that, creates that little triangle of the trust between the unit, buddies, leaders, family, all connected. And then we also, one of the big things that we did was we made it mandatory that everybody go and get a counselor. And so we have military family life counselors, we have kid health counselors, chaplains that can do this, but we wanted to make sure everybody understood that you have a resource that is protected. You can go see one of these MPLEX, as we call them, and they don't take notes, they don't report to the entire chain of command, they don't do anything. It's all private. And a lot of people, a lot of our soldiers didn't know we have those MPLEX in our ranks. Did that. So one, we expose them to the resource and tools that are available that they didn't know. Two, they found out that, hey, yeah, I could tell this guy or the woman anything, and it's a safe place. And then three, what we found out is that a lot of people would have never raised their hand to go see counseling, got counseling, and they needed it. That's about a 25-30% of our force. We forced them to go in there, and they actually got help if they needed it. Or ask for, hey, I need to bring my spouse in too, and we need to go over communications or whatever. So that's really what Mission 100 is. And I try to share, you know, we share that with our colleagues of the Air Force, and as Nate talked about with Dave Bartley, who came in, who's really helped us out with understanding why people want to, you know, take their own life. It's because he's gone through that. So it is a community effort. It's like we all talked about. It's that connection, it's that ownership on my watch that the FAG talked about as well. It's like, I own this. This is our problem. We've got to fix it. The way we do it is by connecting. I don't need a lot of PowerPoint slides. I don't need a lot of different new ideas and stuff like that. I need to connect. I need to trust. And as a leader, we need to own this. So it's the same thing with sexual assault or any of the other bad behaviors that are out there. We have to own that. I think that's what collective we're all trying to do.
Aaron, do you want to add anything?
I love what the Army's been doing. And I think that one of the great things we have up here is we all, just like you talked about, we're going to take best practices. So anything that they're doing, we're looking to incorporate. I'm pleased with some of the results we've seen, particularly in Alaska. As we continue to come out of COVID, I've been worried, quite frankly, I've been worried that the isolation, that some of the things have been going on, I think that those are not short-term effects. I think that those have been long-term effects. So we know that this is not a sprint. This is a marathon, and we've got to keep going. We cannot ease up in any way.
Senator Rivak, follow up?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for everything, for all the attention you're putting on it. I know it's a big issue for you as commanders, and certainly for us as leaders in Alaska. It's not isolated to any one constituency for certain. But to see positive impacts, I know it's something hard to quantify. It's easy to quantify the number of deaths by suicide, and seeing that number go down is very encouraging. And so thank you very much for your effort to those ends.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair to General Crum, I appreciate the slide, especially on opportunities for state assistance. There's many in the state level that think that we don't have a hand because, you know, you're federal, the DOD or the VA, so there's not much that we can do. But kind of spelling it out for us is beneficial, and I think there's a lot that we can work on in the future. One thing I did want to note on, and Rear Admiral Moore kind of touched on it a little bit as well, is the housing issue that we have either down in Kodiak or up in Fairbanks. With some of the renewed focus we have, especially strategically in Alaska, do you think we're prepared for a more influx of soldiers coming up here for permanent housing, or do you think we're still kind of further along than we should be? What's your opinion on that?
Representative Nelson, I can't speak to the Army. I know.
No worries.
But the only place right now that we know of that there's going to be a significant addition is going to be at Eielson. With the addition, again, the additional F-35 personnel, we'll finish that up. That's roughly 100, 150 more than what we have right now. It could be changing for the summer. The BCS is a move to send out. And then the addition of the PC Warden 35 Active Association. So because it's such a small community, you know, just a couple of dozen people can have a big impact on the housing. And so, again, we're pleased with how the community started to respond. I don't know that as long as we continue those efforts, I'm optimistic. And what I would like to make sure of is we don't make this a zero-sum game to say, hey, we think we have 200 people going in, 100 of them will need homes, we're going to build exactly 100 homes. Because we, as I'm sure everyone, we want to have a healthy housing market. And the housing market, I'm not sure anywhere it's healthy right now, but that's what we need. And it's particularly problematic for our soldiers and our airmen up in the Wainwright, Eielson area, just because those are the areas you just can't, unlike some of the places in Lower 48, and to a small extent here, you can just go a little further out, find a community, and be there. So people that could find housing, say here at J-Bear, can go to Equilibrium and then go to Wasilla Palmer. That becomes quite a bit of a drive, but they still have those options. Those options aren't as ready available there. So managing that small area, I think, is key. And again, I'm very optimistic if we continue the efforts that the local authorities are doing. I think we'll be there.
Representative Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to apologize. I have to leave in a couple minutes for another meeting. So there's just two comments I wanted to make and then a quick question. The first on the issue of suicide, just thank you to everyone who's taking a leadership role in addressing that. My brother is a veteran who died of suicide, and that is an issue that, you know, every time I see a story, it's a very personal experience. And I just want to thank the leadership of General Sachs and prior to him working with General Andreziak, because I was surprised to learn that many of the soldiers who were dying by suicide had not seen combat. And so I was sort of connecting that possibly to their, you know, experience in combat and the trauma from that. And so what we talked about is adverse childhood experiences and some of the things that soldiers are bringing to you when they're enlisted. And I just want to offer that resource and information sharing if it's helpful for any of the other folks. As you've transitioned into your positions, I've been on the JAS committee for 8 years. And so I've been trying in every opportunity I have to share this kind of information to the extent I think it can help us collectively address the problem, and want to share that with all of you if you're interested. General Sachs, thank you for sharing about your sexual assault efforts. We updated our consent statute in Alaska this year. We based it on the military code of justice. So your good work and your efforts to address sexual assault mean that everyone in Alaska will benefit from it. Very big deal, very big deal. And, you know, our Latin language matches your language in significant ways. And to hear now that you're being looked at as a leader, we knew you probably did the right thing. We look to your leadership and our work. And to hear now that that is making a difference, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. My question is for General Crum, and going back to that first slide where you talked about the small UAS, the unmanned aircraft system. Just wanted to give you a little bit of time to maybe explain that a little bit more, because we've actually been a leader. We've tried to invest in the university to develop this industry. Are we being concerned about domestic threats? Is it, you know, international threats? Just sort of like situate us. Are we needing to do something about that right now?
Mr. Senator, thank you. The way I'd capture our concerns are people utilizing those devices in unauthorized areas. And some of that is ignorance, and some of it is not. And so we need to continue to get the word out. We need probably better ways on protecting from those that aren't ignorant, maybe some of those that are. Our, you know, military facilities, you know, there are sensitive things going on, and we need to protect those things. we are very happy with some of the work the university in particular is doing. I think some of the work in unmanned vehicles are great, and we would not only accept that, I would ask you to continue that and expand it. We're looking at more of the nefarious activities of people, and they think, oh, I can just fly this in airspace. I can just do this right here. As we all know, Alaska is a land of freedom, and a lot of people like to do the things they want to do, and some of them have gone, well, why can't I fly my device here? And so it's been education, but we're working very closely with the FAA. The rules for the use of those in our airspace as a nation, they were never designed for these types of technology. And I think we've got to do some catch up on that. But I think that as long as if I can weed out the people who are not doing it nefariously, then I want to focus on it. And we do this with local authorities. If we find someone that is trying to use those for harm, then we'll work with the local authorities to make sure we build those people up.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I noticed in the second year in a row, Lieutenant General Crum, that you've mentioned childcare as a challenge for your community. And we'll just note that the legislature came pretty close, actually, to funding a childcare trust, because childcare is a crisis throughout the state. You can make more money working at Starbucks than you can providing care for children, and obviously that's really a challenge. And I think that as we work on making our community more military friendly, making sure that we have all the resources necessary to support the military, including childcare, I think is really important. But I actually have a question for Rear Admiral Moore. You mentioned the issue around communications infrastructure and using potentially IGA funds to find new sources of energy for some of your communications infrastructure. Are you looking at, experimenting with wind and solar, which actually work really well in many parts of rural Alaska? Really, a lot of coastal communities have a lot of winds. Are you guys exploring that at all or testing that?
Yeah, thanks, Admiral Moore here from District 17. So the Coast Guard, the entire Coast Guard, is looking at replacing our communications network for search and rescue coordination across the entire Coast Guard. And what actually happened for us years ago is that the system that we have in place up here in Alaska is not equivalent to what most of the lower 48 has, and that's how we've got kind of two separate tracks. And what we're moving forward with today is a solution that will be a replacement for the entire coast of the United States, which includes Alaska. So it'll be a common system that will be, the software will be common, it will be upgraded accordingly, and that's a good thing for us here in District 17 in Alaska, because then we will no longer have our separate system that is somehow supported differently and with different functionality. The technology today will clearly get us to something that is, either satellite based or in some way something that is less maintenance intensive than those diesel power generators right now. That was kind of.
All right, thank you.
Colonel Vakalis. Thank you, Chairman Clayman. I hate to do this, but General Crump, could you come up and just answer a question? Clarify?
Absolutely.
Sir, you had mentioned in your briefing about perhaps needing some assistance in trying to mitigate soils here in Alaska as opposed to having to ship them out. Are we talking about petroleum product contamination, or are we talking about trying to cure some of the evils from World War II that was left over here, and at the time that they were disposed of, they were done according to the book, but now the book has changed? So are we kind of talking about that type of stuff? I'm just not sure.
So what I was specifically addressing was, in particularly the F-35 construction that we did up at Allison, we discovered a lot of soil that was contaminated. And quite frankly, a lot of it has some perforin PFAS, which are, as unfortunately, and they are, for chemicals. So I would say that we haven't had as much issue with some of the soil that's been contaminated by petrochemicals. There are methods that we can use to alleviate that process. This is more of the things that won't be alleviated by time. And so when the last time I spoke with Penny, one of the things that all of you asked me was, what are some interesting things that the military has problems with that the state can be innovative on? That was just one of the things that my team came up with and said, hey, as we continue to work in Alaska and we continue to do these things, maybe this is an opportunity for the state.
Absolutely. Go ahead and turn off the chaos.
I'd just like to say to the leaders here, thank you so very, very much for what you do and for the people that you represent. You know, we in Alaska really appreciate it, and we appreciate what you do for Alaska and the nation. Thank you.
Now, Bill, any questions? I know not required, but you haven't gotten the cue.
Yes, thank you. First, General Crum, your message, your points about the need for behavioral health specialists is well taken in Alaska that has a shortage statewide. Currently, starting up is a new initiative between the Department of Health, University of Alaska, private providers, and philanthropy towards growing our behavioral health workforce and cultivating more students going in there. Provided we can meet all the DOD regulations that would be involved, would you and General Eichler support that, do you think, participating in that from with the military perspective?
I think we would love to help in any way that we could.
Thank you.
And Senator Schauer, Representative Tuck, Senator Kawasaki, you've been silent, but you're online. Any questions? I'll ask Senator Schauer first. Any questions or comments?
Thank you. Excuse me. Boy. Thank you, Representative Craven. I have a tough time with my voice there. I am not going to ask questions. There have been great ones. I just want to say thank you to all of our senior military officers and their support staff, everybody, in fact, that showed up. They're busy. They have a lot on their plate, and it always takes a lot of their time to come do this. So I appreciate their time and all their sacrifice and service. I know some of them pretty well. At this point, I don't want to take any more of that time. And always ask them offline. So I just want to offer a thank you for the service, and thank you for coming in today to give us the latest and greatest. Appreciate it.
Representative Tuck, any questions? Either you're muted or you're not responding. I'll ask Senator Kawasaki any questions. Senator Kawasaki. We've left them both speechless. All right, Senator Reinbold, I see you have a follow-up.
Thank you. I have two general questions. So any of you gentlemen that would like to answer, I'm not sure exactly who to ask the first one to, but we came up here. My father was an electrical engineer. He came up as the general manager of the Clear Air Force Station for the ballistic early warning system. There's a fire there right now, and I would like a real update.
I took an update at noon. The fire, as of this morning, was about a mile away from where we would have to start issuing mandatory evacuations from Clear. We're hopeful that the rain is helping us. It's slowed. I think we'll know more over the next couple of days, but it's certainly been a concern for us. But right now, we're optimistic that the rain's going to help. I'm a little bit worried about, especially the amounts of rain that they told me we might get this weekend in some of the areas that already have fire damage and got washouts. So that's the latest that I got this morning. Please hold on.
Either follow up or the next question.
Thank you. That place is, I feel, my homeland. That's what brought my entire family. So as she has connections in certain areas, this is an extremely passionate area of mine, the Clear Air Force area. So if there's anything I can do, I'm not sure if there is, but I certainly, that is something that I'm watching closely.
Senator, we've been sending equipment from Allison Air Force Base, Wainwright, and Jay Bear to help assist. So it's been an all-out effort from all your military units here to help make sure that, you know, we're helping with the fire breaks. We're doing all sorts of things. Everything that they've asked for, we've been able to send.
And in regards to Clear Air Force Station, I know there's housing, recreational services, there's a whole bunch of issues. I was able to take a tour a couple years ago. They were incredibly gracious to me. It was amazing. Thank you, General Staff, from the depths of my heart. It was an amazing experience going back up there. And so I really do care deeply about the housing situation, what's going on there, and the recreational issues. I have committed to helping that. And the last and final question that I have today is, you all take an oath to defend and uphold our Constitution. And sometimes orders come down. And sometimes you as leaders need to step in the gap. You need to be the ones that defend the people when this order can and does cause harm, whether it's emotional, mental, physical harm to the soldiers. And I'm very concerned about the COVID vaccine. You guys all know this. I've made it incredibly clear. I used to work for biotech, and I used to work in healthcare management. Some of the things that are going on are violating constitutional rights. They're violating federal laws. They're violating state statutes, and they're putting big pharma in control. And I'm just going to admonish all of you, step in the gap for the soldiers. We depend on you to protect us. They depend on you to protect them. And I will step in the gap for them. I'm just here to tell you this is a very concerning issue, and I will be having a symposium in regards to this. So it's not misinformation. It will be expert-based information. And I do think every individual that is pushing this needs to be held accountable. So with that, I want you guys to take this to the depths of your heart, to just be cautious and defend the people that are under you.
Thank you. Any other questions for any of the military folks who provided testimony? I'm not seeing any. So I'm going to thank everyone for your attendance today. We are going to adjourn this meeting of the Joint Armed Service Committee. I specifically want to thank Lieutenant General Crum, Major General Eifler, Rear Admiral Moore, and Major General Sachs for your participation today, and we are adjourned.